Welcome to the 117th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Andrew Mayer, author of the Society of STEAM trilogy. His latest novel is Power Under Pressure. Stay tuned for the interview. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Andrew Mayer, author of the Society of STEAM trilogy, The Falling Machine, Hearts of Smoke and Steam, and his latest book, Power Under Pressure, which was just published. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, as we get going, I wondered if you could just read the first page or two of your new novel, Power Under Pressure.
Sure. I'd be glad to. All right. I'll start at the beginning. Chapter one, Spiritus Sanctus. Emilio Armando pushed back his hat and mopped the sweat from his brow. While his workshop was a perfect place to work in the winter months, the change of seasons had transformed his beloved space into a sweatbox. May had been relatively gentle, but now the last vestiges of spring were disappearing, and the sun was rising earlier and higher day by day, beating down longer and longer on the wooden and iron train car that contained his steam-powered machines. Without some modifications, he'd be completely unable to work in the studio by day, and would instead be relegated to spending only the nights inside. Hidden and gathering dust in a nearby cupboard drawer were the extensive plans he had put together to allow him to regulate the temperature all year round, with the obvious exception of the infernal temperatures that often arrived in July and August. Any day where the mercury topped the 100-degree mark, the heat would be impossible to escape from. And the arrival of a steam engine and other materials that he had liberated from the theater mechanique after the tragedy only added to the problem. Although the main boiler was being kept outside, it would ultimately power an array of vents and fans that might allow him to work in an environment where the bulk of his day wasn't spent wringing out his handkerchief. So far, that hadn't happened. Ever since he'd first seen Vincent's workshop out in the garden behind the theater, Emilio had harbored a secret dream of converting his own workplace into one of equal grandeur. Of course, he would have never imagined it would be possible for him to afford the equipment. But it had turned out that owning a junkyard had allowed him to gather up almost all the valuable material from the condemned building as scrap. Even the cost of hauling it back on the ferry had been such that he had been forced to sell some of it to simply pay for the transport costs. Still, he was now in possession of not only a massively powerful steam engine, but lathes and drills that he could have once only dreamed of. And yet all the new equipment had left his once perfect little workshop a shambles, and getting it back together was a project in itself. Like the old tale of the monkey's paw, having all your dreams come true was turning out to be far more of a curse than a blessing. The fact that it had arisen from the same tragedy that disfigured his sister only made the irony sharper. There had been such a cost in blood, the price paid by both Vincent and his sister. Emilio squinted and shook his head with a single violent nod as he tried to break the connection between these machines and Viola's scarred face. It had been weeks since the accident, but when he closed his eyes, he could still see her the way that she had been when the wounds had been fresh, the huge gashes in her flesh, like a piece of meat from the butcher. But finding some good in that bad did not make him a monster. Letting out a sound that landed perfectly between a grunt and a sigh, he sat himself back down at his workbench and picked up one of the metal rings he had machined the previous night. He dropped it down over a set of metal pins sticking up from the object strapped to the table in front of him. There was no mistaking that it had been designed as a long metal limb, and the metal collar had been put into a position where a human might have a shoulder. It was a tight fit, but it had been very precise with his measurements, and with the application of a little oil, he managed to shuffle it back and forth until it set firmly in place against the armature. When he was sure it was fully down, he gave the ring another turn, looking to find where the catch was supposed to lock it into place, and instead it slipped free. "Damn it," he said, surprising even himself with the choice to say that word in English. Frustrated by his stupidity, Emilio tried to wrestle the metal back into place. When that didn't work, he pulled his hands away and let out a grunt.
Great. Well, if the listeners haven't heard or read about your Society of STEAM trilogy yet, how would you describe the books and the story that you're telling?
I mean, the easy and the quick way is superhero steampunk. So I've put together sort of what I loved about, you know, classic superhero storytelling, and, you know, what I think are the fundamental elements of steampunk. And, you know, to me, they work together nicely. Create a world where sort of, and so it's a story of a superhero team, both the dissolution of an old team of superheroes, the Society of Paragons, and sort of the corruption inside of them that tears them apart, and the birth of a new superhero team called the Society of STEAM, that sort of rises up from the ashes of the old team.
Great. And so you mentioned comic books and superheroes. Are there specific creators and comics that you were inspired by? Are you a Jack Kirby fan or?
Yeah, well, the third book is dedicated to him, so I'd say that's a giveaway right there. I actually met Jack Kirby. I got to interview him before he died back in like 1992. So yeah, he was a big influence on me, really, even before I started writing this series. I mean, just the way he looked, you know. I mean, here's, you know, this guy from Brooklyn who sort of grew up on the streets and, you know, was in World War II and then eventually went on to sort of create the fundamental mythology of both the Marvel and the DC universes. So, you know, to me, that's a pretty good track record for a kid who grew up in the streets of New York.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. And his artwork, I mean, if you're someone who, you know, that resonates with it, it resonates so powerfully. It's even hard to sometimes even and describe that, as you said, it's kind of, you know, mythology.
Yeah. I mean, he was really into it. I mean, you know, and I mean, I think it, you know, he wanted to tell these stories of fathers and sons and, you know, great. So, I mean, the story I always tell about the interview was the point where he's like, you know, talking about the Silver Surfer, the character, you know, the guy who rides through space on a gleaming silver surfboard. And he's like, yeah, we saw these pictures of these guys out in California and they were riding on the ocean on a stick. And I was like, what if this guy rides out in space on a stick? And I was like,
<That's> right. Great.
He just had that way of taking these things and sort of, you know, I mean, I think that's his art style too. It's like simple, but powerful. Right.
Yeah,
and it adds a lot of depth in there. And, you know, I mean, you look at the Marvel movies now. I mean, I think a lot of, you know, the reinterpretation, like the Thor movies especially, I'd say, are really deeply based on, you know, that sense of grandeur that he created.
Sure, sure. Well, do you remember what gave you the original idea or inspiration for sitting down and writing the Society of Steam trilogy?
Yeah, so I was trying to figure out, you know, it's funny. I mean, originally it started out as a comic book pitch, unsurprisingly, although I would say that the funny thing about the series is that where the books end at the end of the third book is really where I would have started if I had been writing it as a comic series. And there's a lot of reasons for that, just in terms of the way the media work and the type of storytelling you want to do in different mediums. But you know, I was at Burning Man I started writing it in 2007, and I was at Burning Man in 2006. And when I was walking around, a bunch of people showed up. There's a thing called the Never Was Hall. It's H-A-U-L. It's a freestanding self-powered Victorian house that they've created over in Oakland, and they trotted out a fair amount. And it was at the time it was being pulled by a steam-powered tractor. Kinetic Steamworks. I mean, I went back and figured out who all these folks were later.
Right.
But anyway, this thing shows up being pulled by this beautiful tractor, huge, you know, handcrafted tractor, and then zipping all around it are these little cars with propane powered steam engines, and you know, everybody's dressed up in Victorian clothes. And I was like, okay, this is kind of happening. Like, I can kind of feel this. And then one of the guys I worked with, Peter Overstreet, who's an illustrator, great illustrator, has worked on a bunch of video game stuff. You know, I talked to him about it a little, and he's like, yeah, you know, if you're going to place this really, you know, 1860 to 1920 is your time period. And, you know, I started looking at the history of, and I decided to place it in New York rather than London. And, you know, I got really inspired by the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge as sort of this metaphor, for the period. And so that's how I ended up with 1880, which is where the book is set now. And so, you know, I ended up sort of being inspired and doing it in 1880s New York. And, you know, New York was a, you know, I couldn't imagine doing superhero. You know, like, New York is so integrated to the world of superheroes that I love. You know, you look at goes back to Jack Kirby, right? And then also just, you know, the Marvel 1960s stuff, which was a big inspiration for me as well.
Sure, sure. Well, steampunk is obviously a genre that continues to grow in popularity. How do you interpret it, and what appealed to you about that time period and that kind of you know, the kind of trappings of steampunk?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, right? I think when you look at a lot of other genres, there's a couple things that are different, right? One is that most genres come out of some massively successful piece of, especially fiction genres, come out of some massively successful book or movie that sort of inspires it, which steampunk hasn't really had. So that's interesting. So, you know, I often struggle because I think that one thing is with steampunk, there's a lot of different interpretations of where the strength of the genre is. But for me, the more I got into it and the more the time I spent with it, the realization that I had is that, you know, the Victorian era is sort of the birthplace of the, of our relationship with technology and, you know, sort of our modern cultural philosophy, right? Modern Western cultural philosophy, I think, was really, you know, we're still living in their world to a greater or lesser degree. So what I like about it is that when you look sort of backwards through the telescope, right, you know, they're looking towards a future where, you know, where they're going to own the world and they're going to be, you know, eating all these resources and taking over the world itself. And we're looking back and seeing sort of this naive beginning, but also a simpler world, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the powers I think about it, one of the reasons if you read that opening, right, I mean, that sort of a distillation of what people like and dislike about my writing, which is, you know, the technical, the way that I move in, like the way that I sort of look at technical description. But I think it's a simpler time, right? It's objects that were crafted and that form followed function. You could look at what was in your hand and understand the intention of what it was supposed to do. Whereas, you know, you look at an iPhone now, and if the thing wasn't turned on, you'd have no idea what to do with it.
Right. Right.
So
interesting.
About, you know, I think part of the fascination of it is it's a metaphor that lets us sort of deconstruct our relationship with technology and the world around us.
Right. You mentioned that you worked in the digital space, working on various video games. What were you doing? Were you doing coding? Were you writing, designing? What was that?
So I've been designing games for almost 20 years. Well, for more, yeah, actually for 20 years now. And, so mostly game design. I've been a producer, designer, consultant. I've never been a coder. I mean, I've written code, but I've never had a game that has my code in it.
Right.
I did do some narrative writing. Interesting that I don't mind doing writing for games. My problem as a designer is that I'm much more interested in interaction and gameplay. And I find that people tend to get very married to narrative. And, you know, from a design, game design perspective, narrative is one of the most, you know, fungible elements, right? It's like compared to everything else you have to do in a game, nothing's cheaper to change than story.
Right.
And as a writer, I know I can generate a lot of it fairly quickly. So, you know, I tend to tell everybody, like, wait, story, you know, my saying is story last, right? Use story as a way to have the interactions of your experience makes sense.
Gotcha. And I'm curious, I mean, obviously this is a writing and books podcast, but I'm a gamer myself. What games have you been playing in the last year or two that really impressed you, either on, you know, a mobile device or you know, an Xbox or PlayStation?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, my focus has been social mobile for the last few years. The last big Xbox game I played is Red Dead Redemption. Mm-hmm. Although I'm Ken Levine and I, the Bioshock guy, have been friends since we were kids. So, you know, I'll be the first up to playing Bioshock Infinite, no, without a doubt. Yeah, I mean, on the mobile side, I mean, I love stuff. What if I play? I mean, for me, it's so tied to, you know, it's so tied to a means to an end. I mean, I love. There's a game called Punch. What is it? Is it Punch Quest? I love this Punch Quest, Happy Street. Like, there's a lot of stuff on the mobile devices that I've been playing the heck out of. I just played, there was a narrative one that I really liked. It was about fire, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, that I picked up off the game store. And the Walking Dead game I thought was great. The Walking game from Telltale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is really, really good.
So had you always wanted to write a novel prior to sitting down and working on The Falling Machine, the first book in the Society of Steam?
Only since I was 12 years old.
So you got sidetracked into working on games?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I had gotten into Clarion West, and I was going to go out to do Clarion West when I got my first game industry job. So I had this real crossroads moment in my 20s where I had to pick, and I had been working on writing. I mean, I was working as a consultant to the Mint, to the San Francisco Mint. And I, you know, my job would be, I would get up, I'd have to be at the office at 7:30. I'd get out at 4:30. I'd go home And at some point in the evening, I'd start writing, and I'd write till about 1 a.m, getting about 5 hours a night. And I did that probably for a couple years. So when I got the game job, I was like, okay, I'm doing creative work here. Maybe I can go out and have some fun and have a social life. And I also felt like the thing that I ran into was at the time, and this was sort of, you know, the previous era, the end of the cyberpunk era, right? The end of the cyberpunk era. I also felt like I wasn't writing from experience. I was writing books that were sort of reinterpretation of themes that I had read in other books. And so like my other goal was to sort of go out and do stuff.
Right. So what were you writing during those 2 years when you said you came home at you know, you got off of work at 4:30? Were you working on short fiction novels and when you said you were kind of reinterpreting what you had read?
Yeah, a lot of short stories, because it was still the era where you would build your career by getting short stories into magazines first. Mm-hmm. You know, Analog, and I was pretty close. I mean, I didn't get stuff published, but I was at that. There was a sort of a hierarchy, right? You would send out your stories. You'd start getting notes from editors, right? And that's what Clarion would have been a supercharge for, right? At that point, you know the editors, and then that was how you got in, right? It was right. There were a lot fewer authors, a lot less published, so you really had to sort of build that connection. I was already getting feedback from editors, like, you know, I would take this if you did this, right? Or, you know, this is great. Keep sending me what you're doing. I'm not going to take this one, but I want to see everything you're working on. That kind of right. stuff.
And so then you got the job in the game industry, mm-hmm. In the digital industry. And I'm assuming from the way that you're talking that you maybe put writing on the back burner for a while. Is that correct?
Yeah, I really did. I mean, I focused on that. I focused on the game stuff. I mean, there was some narrative work there. I was writing backstory. I mean, I still have some stuff I did for them. I wrote backstories, or, you know, I'd write the short science fiction piece that would go in the front of the little game or other stuff like that, or in the manual. But I wasn't really focused on narrative, on fiction. Yeah. And you know, honestly, I had been working on this book on a novel, and I just had stalled out about 3/4 of the way through.
Gotcha. Yeah. So what was the epiphany around sitting down and working on The Falling Machine? Was it what you related earlier of seeing this this mechanical house at Burning Man?
Well, I knew I wanted to write a book. I come to this point where it's like, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to have a career as an author, I've reached the point in my life that either I'm going to do this or I'm going to have it as a regret that for the rest of my life. I mean, I don't. People do get started in their 40s and 50s, but you know, I felt like getting into my late 30s at that point, and I was like, okay, if this is going to happen, if this is something I'm going to do, I need to get rolling now. And there's a thing that I think that happens with fiction, with being an author, where, you know, the point at which, you know, it's like college. The point at which you start writing is your graduating class, to some degree. So, you know, like Gail Carriger and Sherry Priest and Mary Robinette Kowal, those are all people that I know because those are the people that I started publishing with.
Right.
Right. And so I think you also want to do that where you feel like those are your actual peers. Right. Yeah. And that makes life a little easier and a little more fun.
So I'm just curious. I don't mean to pry too much. I just you know, so what was the kind of decision making process like for you? So you kind of started feeling like, you know, I don't want to get into my 40s and 50s. So what happened from there until you sat down and started working on The Falling Machine?
I mean, I think for me, a big change. Well, one, I had started reading. You know, I had been working on breaking into comics for the 5 years prior to that. Mm-hmm. So I had been doing a lot of narrative work. I just was sort of thinking that, you know, comics, that was the mid-2000s. So comics were, you know, 2003 through 2007, the movie deals were coming through fast and furious. The comic movies were taking off. There was money around. People were interested in new properties. And then really what happened in 2007 was I had gotten a deal with Top Cow to do a book with a friend of mine. And when the economy crashed, a lot of the money deflated from there and they canceled the book and said they were only going to work on existing IP.
Right.
Only on existing characters, nothing new. And that's not interesting to me. Like I you know, I have a lot of friends in comics who they want nothing more out of life than to write Batman. And my interest in writing actual Batman is about zero. Mm-hmm. Like if they came to me and said, "Hey man, we want you to do Batman. We love you." I would figure something out. But my goal as a writer is not to build. I worked at Cartoon Network as a creative director in 2000, 2001. I've gotten to play with Batman. I've gotten to play with, you know, Powerpuff Girls, all the stuff that was the big toys back then. And the problem I have with it is it's never yours, right? Like Batman will never, like I can play with Batman, I can hang out with Batman, but Batman will never love me.
Sure.
So, you know, that was my interest in writing comics that were for existing IP was really limited. And I saw, you know, I mean, books were a way that I could get back into creating my own worlds and my own characters.
Sure. So what is your writing process like? Do you outline extensively or are you more of an organic writer?
Yeah, I don't know if I believe. I mean, I know that people claim that they're organic writers. That was why I never finished the previous novel. Like I'm not an organic writer in any way. Like I ended up reading Robert McKee's storybook because I felt it had a lot of relevance to the comic stuff as well. And I just started out and like he was like, look, you don't get one of the things he writes about in the back of the book where he gets the actual, you know, he's like, whatever, 90% of it is really sort of philosophy and the last 10% of the book is technique, right? But one thing he says at the back of the book is, don't write a word of dialogue until you've outlined your entire story, right? And made sure that you've created something worth telling. And, you know, and then dialogue will turn into your dialogue's the treat that you get, right? Because we're all, you know, like most of us who are good at writing are good at dialogue. We have an ear for it, right? I mean, I think some people probably don't, but you know, most of us can at least personally enjoy that, right? And holding that out as the carrot at the end of the stick and saying you don't get to do it, that was really motivating for me, right?
Right.
And that was really a big part of it. So I ended up shifting into being an outliner. And that's just become a key part of everything I do now. You know, I don't have to follow it slavishly and it's built as I go along, but knowing when I open up a new chapter in Scrivener that I know what I'm supposed to be writing about or what the emotional goal or the narrative goal or the character goals are, it helps a lot.
And how was that shift for you? Cause you said that you got 3/4 of the way through this novel and had it kind of stall out on you. Was it something that you had to kind of adjust to of basically plotting out every last detail before you started working?
Well, I don't do every last detail, right? I mean, it's about breaking it down into beats that are motivating.
Yeah.
So, you know, no, it was great. It was like a revelation, right? Suddenly I was interested. And for me anyway, like I knew there were parts that I was excited about writing. So it's very motivational, right? Like, oh, now I get to do this scene, right? Like in the first book, I mean, I opened pretty strong with the book, with the battle on the... Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I open up with the battle on the Brooklyn Bridge in the first one, but there's a huge set piece that ends book two, or what I think of as a set piece, right? It takes place in a certain location and I have a good sense of what the stakes are and the whole book two is about the joy of getting to the point where I had earned the right to write that sequence. And it was all, you know, it was a lot of fun for me.
That's great. Well, what books or authors have you read in the past couple of years that really stood out for you and that you would recommend?
Well, obviously I'm a big fan of Gail Carriger's work. You know, the Parasol Protectorate stuff. I mean, I think she's just got a great sense of fun in that. I'm trying to think recent stuff. Yeah. Ready Player One. I love, I can't remember the name of the author of that one.
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of the author either.
I love,
Ernest Cline. Is that it?
Okay. Yeah. That's a great book. Also, they just came out with a movie of it. Guy who writes Dies at the End, I think is a great book. Oh, Paolo Bacigalupi, also amazing writer. Love The Wind Up Girl. Scott Westerfeld, huge influence on me. I mean, the fact, it was a really, you know, I like him a lot and I read his stuff and then he, like, I didn't know he was going into steampunk when I went in. And so it was like, oh man, how do I compete with, you know, like, here's a guy that I really look up to and I think is amazing. Now he's on my turf, you know, and I think, you know, his books, obviously, you know, his books are amazing. Who else am I thinking of? There's one other guy that I wanted to mention. Hold on a second. Let me think of. This is me typing his name in. Kay Morgan, another guy I love, and his new fantasy series, the Steel Remains stuff, is great. Like I love his stuff. And
say his name again. I didn't catch it.
What?
I didn't catch his name. Can you say it again?
Sure. Richard K. Morgan.
Okay, got it.
He did Altered Carbon books, and Altered Carbon was sort of a noir, and then he did Broken Angels and Woken Fury. So was it the same character in the same world that sort of switched genres in each novel? The Takeshi Kovacs books, which I think are great. You know, and George Martin is a big influence. I love the first three of the Game of Thrones stuff. And obviously, like, I mean, you know, I'll stick through it to the end. I think the series is, you know, he's a great writer. I mean, I think I'll be interested to see that when the series is done, whether he goes back and sort of re-edits them. Because I've gotten to now, it's hard to deny without any... taking away anything from a guy who's obviously one of the kings of the industry right now. You know, I think the books have become as much, whether he likes it or not, whether I like it or not, the books have become as much about the publishing schedule as they have about the narrative.
Yeah. I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan, and I think I've read the series two or three times, and I agree with you. I think that, I don't know. I mean, of course it's not my place to say, given, you know, like you said, he's a giant, but I think the story kind of got away from him. In my opinion.
Well, I mean, my feeling is this. I think, you know, with my own experience, right, you want a world that's deeper and richer than the story that you're telling, right? Because the idea that the tapestry is larger than the vision that you have inside of it is, I think, always really compelling to the reader, right? That you can walk off the edge of this world, off the edge of the frame that you're experiencing it in, and that you could imagine that there's more going on outside the edges than in your head.
Sure.
And I think for the first three Game of Thrones book, it really felt that way. And somewhere in the last two novels, I feel like he's put everything, all the backstory onto the page.
Yeah.
I know when I meet a new character, I know the battle that their uncle lost, right? That made them angry so that they want to hurt Tyrion. It's not that I don't care about that. It's that if that doesn't feel sort of like intuited, going back to game theory, right? Game design stuff. The one thing that I've learned over the years is that if I feel personal, like one thing I think is an important trick or technique, let's not call it a trick, is that if you tell the user what to do, they hate it. But if they discover what to do, even though that's what you intended, and they own it and they love it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the Martin books have done for me, is that they feel at this point as if I don't get to come, you know, I don't get to intuit that, oh, maybe this guy has some bad blood with Tyrion. He's telling me exactly where that bad blood is coming from. And I'm sort of like, okay, then I don't really care. It's not really mine. I didn't really discover or explore this world myself. I was led by the hand through the world.
Sure, like, sure.
And that's, you know, look, it's a tough thing when you're writing. More than anything else, when you're writing, at some point you just have to let go and let your instinct guide you. Because no matter how good you get at it, you can't be the writer and the reader simultaneously. You know?
Sure, sure. So given your experience with the Society of Steam trilogy and writing it and having it published with these beautiful covers by Peer. What advice do you have for aspiring writers?
It's, you know, it's a tough time. I mean, I think it depends on what you want to get out of it, right? I mean, a lot of people want to write. I feel really lucky that I got in when I did, because I had a dream of being on a bookshelf in Barnes & Noble, and that dream came true. And I think the window for that dream to come true is pretty much over. I mean, you know, there's 1,000 people or more who read my book because it was, you know, blown out at Borders, right?
Yeah.
When Borders went out of business, right? And that was bad for me in a number of ways. And I think good in some senses that people read the book. But, you know, the market is so fundamentally, I'm thrilled that people are out there reading and that there still are readers, but it's not the same as it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So I think you really have to know what you want to get out of it, and you have to know what you want to offer the audience. And you have to know, but I think the first thing is more important, right? Who are you writing for? What's the craft that you're looking to build? And are you willing to be patient and build it as a craft? Because it's not something, you know, and that's the danger of self-publishing, right? Is that you can publish
anything.
It's easy to get it out there. And, you know, you need, you know, so, and I don't think it's a mistake to get your early stuff out there. It's fine to put whatever you want on Amazon. You know, just commit to writing the next one and the next one and the next one.
Sure. So what are you working on now? Do you have a follow-up plan for the Society of Steam?
Well, so I spent, you know, 5 years, you know, I'm not, one thing I've learned about myself is that, like, unlike some authors, right, I don't shed a lot of short stories and other fiction while I'm working on a large body of work. So, I mean, you know, it ended up being that for 5 years, I worked on nothing but Society of Steam. I published a short Christmas piece in that world, the end of last year. And, you know, I'll be back, right, with that world, but I'm also exploring some other concepts now. So I'm not sure yet. I think what's going to happen with Society of Steam is I'm going to do a series of short pieces that are going to connect together. You know, they'll seem a little disparate right now, and then they're going to connect together in a way that will set up the next, series of the book. That's my plan. Gotcha. How long that takes, I just want to sort of take this year and sort of work on it in a more big picture abstract way. And then I think in, you know, next year I'll start back into the series in earnest.
Great. Well, where can people find you online?
So my home is andrewpmayer.com. And that's the best way to find me. And I'm Andrew Mayer without the P on Twitter.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Andrew Mayer, author of the Society of Steam trilogy. The latest book, Power Under Pressure, is available in bookstores now, so check it out. Andrew, thanks for doing the podcast.
Well, once again, thanks for having me on. I always enjoy it, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.